What's up? Welcome to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd not joined by my regular co-host, Thomas Drance. Instead, we've got Canucks color commentator here on Sportsnet 650, my guy Randeep Janda in the house. What's going on, man?
What's going on, Jamie? Good to be back. It was, about a month ago that we kind of hung out for a little bit anyways. I don't know. You and Bick kind of combine into... to one person.
Are you talking about when we were at Nat Bailey?
No, that was last week.
I was going to say, that was last week. What are you talking about?
I was in studio as well. Here's the thing. The off season kind of mixes all together. Last week might as well have been like 2 months ago.
I haven't seen you for months. It's like, sir, we talked last week.
Literally 7 days ago.
At Nat Bailey. What are you talking about?
I totally forgot about that.
I haven't had a co-host because Drance has been in California for like forever now.
Nice little gig he's got there, by the way.
Hey, man. I don't ask questions about it. I just do what I'm told. I haven't had a co-host in a month, so this is great for me to have some company in studio here on a Friday afternoon. Canucks Talk is brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650, 650. Is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And we got a lot to get into today, Randeep. Just a little teaser here. We might have some fresh sneak preview 32 Thoughts audio at some point during the show of Elliot Friedman connecting the Canucks to another UFA forward that we haven't necessarily heard directly connected to the Canucks in the run-up to free agency here. So stand by for that. One of the few times it pays to have Dom Shamati as the producer of the show. He's getting us the audio.
Days like today is where he makes his money.
That's right.
But that, my friends, is what you call a tease
That's
in our
right.
business. Very
so,
well done.
So a little, some, again, this is exclusive to Sportsnet 650. 32 Thoughts won't be dropping till tomorrow, but at some point in the show, we're going to get the clip, and we'll pass that along from Elliot Friedman. And, of course, Game 6 of the Stanley Cup Final tonight. The big question: will this season mercifully end? Can we get this over with? Like, and I feel terrible saying that because Connor McDavid's having this historic, historic performance, right? He's going to win the Conn Smythe probably no matter whether they win or lose. He's been incredible. There is this inherent drama to, you know, hey, can they come back from 3-0? It should be really exciting. You love to watch high stakes hockey like this, but it's June 21st. The Celtics championship is like, seems like a distant memory at this point. What are we doing here?
The Euros are going on.
The Euros are going on.
Normally, that's a signal that hockey is long gone and an international soccer tournament is going on. But here we have Game 6. And, Jamie, you could go to Game 7, right? It could go to June 24th by the time it's all said and done.
It's painful. It's absolutely painful. We'll talk more about the actual game, but just my goodness, this schedule is a travesty. Like, can we get this over with and get on to the offseason? We got speculation to make, Randy. We got free agents and trades and draft stuff to talk about. Shayna Goldman will join us at 12:30. We'll talk Stanley Cup Final with her. And at 1 o'clock, Ian McIntyre, our guy iMac, from Sportsnet will join us. And that's great because iMac had the big sit-down interview with Jim Rutherford yesterday, published yesterday at sportsnet.ca. You can go check it out. And as always, when Jim Rutherford talks to a member of the media on the record, lots to dig into, lots of interesting commentary. And we can go through some of the key quotes, some of our key takeaways. But the one I want to start with is this quote from Jim Rutherford. And again, this is from Ian McIntyre's interview with the Canucks president up at sportsnet.ca right now. Rutherford says, "We've talked enough to some of our players, and you know, it's really their choice now. And if not, we're only a number of days away from free agency. One way or the other, we'll have a better understanding of what our team is pretty soon." And it's not hard to read between the lines about who Rutherford is talking about there, right? Nikita Zadorov, Dakota Joshua, probably first and second on that list. And the thing I love about that quote from Jim Rutherford, you can say, oh, is he trying to put pressure on them? Is he, you know, exerting some leverage, playing hardball? But the thing I love is just that he's not scared. Jim Rutherford is not scared whatsoever about losing even really good, really important players like Nikita Zadorov and Dakota Joshua, because ultimately they're complementary guys. They're really good complementary players, but they're complementary guys. They're not top of the lineup players for you. And you just can't panic about losing those types of players. Those are when your teams make really, really bad mistakes, right? And we're like, oh man, what are we going to do? What are we going to do about this third line winger? I guess we just have to meet his asking price. Jim Rutherford is not going to do that. That's my number one takeaway from this interview, and that should have Canucks fans very excited that Rutherford has that type of mindset.
Yeah, it's sometimes we forget this guy's already in the Hockey Hall of Fame, right? Like, that's how
yep.
That's how decisive he can be, and sometimes those decisions are good. Sometimes you look back at them, and nobody has 100% success rate. But with Rutherford, I think one of the areas that we got to focus on with him is, you know, everybody's got a price, right? And the higher you go up the lineup, you're able to maybe tweak it a little bit. Maybe the player has more leverage. Maybe there's such a special talent that you're saying, hey, the old Lou Lamoriello line with Bo Horvat, like, we paid too much and it was probably too long, but it's something we had to do. You're able to tweak that to a certain extent for the really special players, right?
Well, we've seen how they've operated, right?
Like, but even with Bo, like here, they said they drew a line, and Lou Lamoriello didn't draw that line.
But you look at the big contracts they've signed, right? JT Miller didn't get close to unrestricted free agency, right? Signed before his the year before, going into his last year on the deal, right? He signed that extension. Elias Pettersson, only an RFA, but signed before the trade deadline, even. Even Filip Pronik, who went past the trade deadline, but well before any, you know, qualifying offer deadlines or free agency or anything like that, when it's been top of the lineup players, they've obviously been very proactive about getting the deals done early. Because as you said, like, those are the guys that you bend for. Those are the guys you go long term. Those are the guys you're willing to pay for. When it's players like Zadorov and Joshua, you got to have a different approach to it.
And there is an element now of, hey, we got something going really strong here. As you saw, last year in the playoffs, you're able to beat Nashville. You're able to take Edmonton to Game 7. And just a little bit of a difference between you and Edmonton. Beyond that, you've got special players, the ones that we referenced. So if you want to be a part of this, whether it's a short-term deal or a long-term deal, we have our price. And if you want to stay here, you kind of have to come back to the middle ground, so to speak. Or maybe, you know, I think of the old episode of 30 Rock where Jack Donaghy is explaining leverage to Liz Lemon. This is kind of that scene where it's like, you know, the cushion in the seat is not done well. It's like, it's basically deflated because you want every ounce of leverage. That's Jim Rutherford in a negotiation to say, we got something going on really, really well right now. And if you want to be here, you're going to have to lean in a little bit because the Canucks are not what they used to be maybe 4 or 5 years ago, where you're paying the Sam Gagnés, you're paying the Michael Delzatos, you're paying, you know, the Antoine Roussel. I'm a friend of the show, but still.
One that I always think of is Tanner Pearson. And, you know, Tanner Pearson was a good player for the Canucks, but when he was going into unrestricted free agency, and I think it was in March, Jim Benning signs him to this extension, you know, at over $3 million per. And it was just, what was the hurry? What was the rush? What was the panic? And I think that previous management regime was always so scared of losing players. Like, oh, Tanner, how are we going to replace Tanner Pearson? We got to keep him here. He's part of this team. And I can understand that when you're talking about top of the lineup guys, but you can't operate in fear once you get out of your core players. And I think the other telling part of that quote from Jim Rutherford is him saying, look, we're only a number of days away from free agency. So he's basically saying, like, hey, we like our players. We would love to keep some of them if the price is right. But we also know that pretty soon we're going to have a chance to remake our team. We're going to have a chance to go shopping and try to replace anybody that does leave. And, you know, he says one way or the other, we'll have a better understanding of what our team is pretty soon. I think the other key thing as we talk about, you know, Rutherford's comfort with uncertainty, right? Comfort saying, hey, maybe guys leave and we have to replace them. That's okay. This team's probably not going to be a finished product on July 1st or July 2nd or July 3rd, right? And again, just look at their track record even since they've been here in Vancouver. Last year, they go get Pugh Suter in August. But even in season, we know how much tinkering they did. Like, okay, first two games of the season last year, this last season against Edmonton, here's some of the guys that featured. Akito Hirose, Anthony Beauvillier, Andre Kuzmenko, Jack Studnicka. None of those were part of the team even coming up to the trade deadline. So we know this management group, the team might look one way, you know, after a week of free agency on July 8th. But by the time the playoffs roll around next year, it's probably going to look very, very different than that because they never stop tinkering.
I think Pugh Suter is a great example because what did we discuss even around July 1st? Hey, this is a player that's versatile. He's going to probably have a couple of teams interested in him. And he had a price, which pretty much through the month of July, nobody met. And eventually, Vancouver was able to get him on a pretty good deal.
Mm-hmm.
And he proved to be a player that played in the top six. So are there players that you identify either that are on your roster currently that might become free agents and that are maybe misjudging their price? Or are there external players? And I think with Dakota Joshua and Nikita Zadorov, there's going to be a lot of suitors.
Yeah, they're not going to be hanging around till August.
They won't. Given their profile, especially with Dakota Joshua and what he can do, there's a lot of teams that watch the playoffs. There's a lot of teams that watch the regular season and say, hey, that's the guy we need. Nikita Zadorov, what do we know? We know he likes Vancouver. We know like the Vancouver Canucks like him as well. What's the price point? One thing with him is you play a game of chicken potentially and say, this is what we want. This is our price. We're not going to go above it. There will be other teams interested in them as well, You know, big guy, physical. And there's a Nashville and Toronto have been mentioned. Two teams I'd be watching and I've been hearing. Columbus and
Insider
St. Louis.
Insider and deep. I
had a lot of free time on my hands in the offseason, all right? Columbus and St. Louis. Those are two teams that are in a weird spot right now. St. Louis has a little bit of money off coming off the books.
Yep.
No RFAs really. And they're trying to kind of reset here. And Columbus is trying to rebuild. They're trying to rebuild a culture. So those are two teams that, in addition to Nashville, Toronto, maybe on the higher end of the NHL, the market will be strong in Nikita Zadorov and Dakota Joshua. But those are a couple of teams that I've heard.
Interesting. And with Zadorov, you know, because part of the other quote from Jim Rutherford, or a quote later on in the piece, was I've always felt that if a player really likes somewhere and they want to stay with that team in that city, they're going to figure out how to do it, whether they have to wait a little while or not. And if they're 50-50 on staying, they're going to be 50-50 regardless. I have confidence that there's going to be some players that really want to stay in Vancouver. And I think that's him, again, you use the word leverage, right? Leveraging the fact that this was a successful season, right? We've heard from reporters that the exit interviews were really positive, lots of good things to say about the coaching staff and the team in general. And I think what Rutherford is kind of implicitly saying here is, well, great, if you like it so much, then you'll leave money on the table. And if you want to do it, then that's awesome. If you say you like it so much, you can demonstrate that by accepting what we're offering to you right now. And hey, if you don't want to accept that, well, maybe you're not actually that motivated to stay here.
And you know what? Everybody's got a self-worth, but it's a very humbling experience at the same time where you're saying top four, top five players on the on an NHL roster get their money. How much of a haircut are you willing to take, right? Like, these guys, at some point in their career, whether it's junior or working their way up, they've been the best player on their team. When you start adding cash to it, Jamie, that's a very different conversation. When we talk about, you know, the difference between a $22 million and a $25 or a $30 million, that's a humbling experience. So on one side, you've got the free market and you've got teams that maybe aren't all that great that are willing to give you some money and say, hey, we want you to be a part of the answer, versus a team like Vancouver. You had some success. You had some, you know, teammates that you got along with. There's a good vibe in the room. Every single player was talking about how this room was different and the culture that was set by the coaches, but other players. What's the cash value? How much of a haircut do you take, right? Yep. But that's the
how
reality.
Much is it actually worth to you?
Yeah,
right.
But you know that's what we talk about—a winning culture. That's what players do. They have to really attach a cash value to it, because if you want a chance at winning, that's generally the road, right?
Yeah, it's, you know, I'm sure Nikita Zadorov could make significantly more money if he signs with the Columbus Blue Jackets. That's also probably the most dysfunctional franchise in the NHL at this point, right? With new ownership in Ottawa, new ownership for formerly the Coyotes, now Utah. That's probably the worst franchise in the NHL at this point. So yeah, they want to reset the culture, all that. That's great, but we know what bad teams have to do to get free agents. They have to overpay significantly to get them in the door, right? I'm sure Nikita Zadorov could make his money, and I won't begrudge him if he does that. Dakota Joshua, I think, is even more clear example. Like, late bloomer, right, who has this incredible opportunity now. He's going to be in demand. I won't begrudge him for a second if he takes the most money somewhere else. But I think that doesn't mean the Canucks have to or should feel the need to match what those other teams are willing to offer, right? Like, you have to have that confidence that you can go out and replace these types of players. And somebody texted in, Big Z is a huge part of this team and he is a must sign. Nobody ever mentions how injury prone Soucy is, and Z will fill the spot no problem if he does go down. Someone like Brendan Dillon and the others you mentioned in the top four is a scary thought. I disagree with that. Like, Zadorov's not the only guy who, you know, more ideal as a third pairing but can fill in the top four in a pinch. You can find those players around the league, like a Brendan Dillon.
One thing we haven't mentioned, though, is the price point, right? Like, is a must sign, but at what number? Are you talking about 5x5? Are you talking about 4.5x6? I know you guys have talked about that number. Like, must sign, if it's a bit of a sweetheart deal for your franchise, sure. But once you start getting into those mid-20s, high 20s, That's a bit of a scary proposition because you do have Soucy for the next couple of years. You have Quinn Hughes on that left-hand side. What is that number? Brendan Dillon, and I remember you guys talked about him yesterday as well, a player that I think a lot of people in this market have been following for a long time. He brought some scoring, a little bit of scoring this year, which is a little bit more than he has in his career. On top of that, he's got that physical edge.
Yep.
And he's not Zadorov in the sense that you got to keep your head up every single moment of the game. Brendan doesn't play that style of hockey necessarily, but he does, you know, throw the body. He stands up for his teammates. So the price point, that's what it comes down to, where, you know, getting Zadorov on a higher number at a longer term, that comes with some risk. But if you get a slightly older player on a shorter term and maybe a shorter annual average, I think Dillon has shown that he can play with John Carlson. He's shown that he can play with, you know, other Erik Karlsson. He can play alongside puck-carrying defensemen and be that stay-at-home option.
650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. We're reacting to some Jim Rutherford quotes from his interview with Ian McIntyre up at sportsnet.ca right now. IMAX going to join us a little later on in the show. And one of the other takeaways for me was this quote from Canucks president Jim Rutherford, who says, we do feel comfortable in the fact that we have four or five guys now from Abbotsford that should be knocking on the door to be with the big team. We have Lekker Mäki coming, which based on his year this year, if he comes in and has a good camp, he'll make a case to be on the team right away. Now, there's a lot of ifs there, right? He's saying if Lekker Mäki comes in and has a good camp, then he'll make a case. He's not even saying if he has a good camp, he'll be on the team. He's saying he'll make a case to be on the team. But that's also a pretty interesting comment from Jim Rutherford, right? And Lekker Mäki is in a fascinating position. And now with Jim Rutherford kind of opening the door for him to make the team at a training camp, because on the one hand, you can understand, hey, this team, what did they need more of in the playoffs? They needed scoring, and they needed offensive punch on the wings. They needed guys with creativity, guys who could put the puck in the net. That's Lekker Mäki's game. But we also know how much Rick Tocchet demands in terms of attention to detail, in terms of defensive effort, all of those things from his players up and down the lineup. This is no slight whatsoever against Lekker Mäki, but just given the position he's in, making the transition to North America, I'd be very surprised if Rick Tocchet was 100% comfortable playing Lekker Mäki a regular shift coming out of training camp. That's just a really high standard for a young player, a young offensive-minded player to live up to, right, given how high Rick Tocchet's standards are. But I wonder if the need for offensive flair in the lineup outweighs that. And could Rick Tocchet have to bend a little bit where Lekker Mäki is considered?
Yeah, this is a really interesting mention because in theory, you're right. The player that he is and the age that he is, there's a long, long way to go. But this is dangling the carrot in front of the player to say, if you do what we ask of you, and if you come in correct and in shape and ready to go, and maybe add some muscle, depending on what that offseason program is for Jonathan Lekker Mäki, we're going to put you in a position to succeed. And the example that I look at is, this time last year, did anybody have Archie Benz playing NHL games last year? I would say probably not. Probably not, unless the team was in a bad way. Him playing games on a winning team, nobody predicted that. But he got 8 games. Of course, it showed that he's got a long way to go still. But I think it's dangling the carrot to say, if you do what you need to do, we have a system here that we're going to give you a look. So, of course, having that trust, that compete, that Rick Tocchet is, that's a, you know, for lack of a better term, a staple for Rick Tocchet. You know he's got the skill. You know he's got the shot. But on those other things, the hockey IQ, all of those things, can you process the game at a high level? That's going to be something that he's going to be thrown in the deep end, even in training camp, and you see how he copes with it. But I think this is a way of saying, you never know what can happen later on in the year. Put yourself in a position to succeed, and you don't have to look too far. There's a couple of guys that got called up this year.
Yeah.
They played some games and they got an opportunity to make a difference.
Now, the difference is Rutherford's explicitly saying, hey, it could be right out of camp.
At camp, yeah. That's
interesting. Now that bar is probably too high.
Yeah.
But I agree with you that the more realistic path is, hey, are you a call up in the second half of the season at some point? Are you an option then if we need you? Now, a couple people texting in, right? I was asking the question, would Rick Tocchet potentially have to bend a little bit in that scenario? And somebody texts in, he didn't bend for Kuzmenko. And I think that's a great point. And that's why I wonder how realistic it really is for Lekker Mäki to open training camp, right? Because we saw how frustrated Rick Tocchet was with the play of Andre Kuzmenko at times last season, eventually leading to his departure. And Kuzmenko didn't lack for skill, but he just could not play the way that Rick Tocchet wanted him to. Now, I do think it's a little different when you have a young player and there's an understanding, hey, we're growing you into something, we're developing it, we know you're going to make mistakes, we can live with that to an extent. I think it's different than, yes, a guy who is in his second season but is a much older player. But it's still a tough sell, right? When you've established the identity of everyone's going to play this way, everyone's going to play hard, everyone's going to commit to defensive responsibility, how much can you really bend for a young player like Lekkerimäki?
And that's a fair question. We haven't really seen it. I think with Kuzmenko, it was, hey, you put up, 39 goals the previous year? All right, we need you to take that next step. For a younger player, it's you're taking baby steps, but you're taking baby steps in the NHL, which is a very, very different proposition. But do you put that player in a position to succeed? And I'm going to go back to Bantz for 1 second, because Arsdeep got an opportunity to play with JT Miller, right? When you look at a guy that's been put up points in the AHL, you're saying, all right, he's leading the team in points. Let's put him in a position he can feel comfortable and some of the other guys can help him out with. That was one moment where Tocchet gave him the opportunity to play with some veteran players. Also gave him a shot on power play one. So there is room to maybe have that flexibility, but in terms of the staples of the game, maybe for a couple of games you can experiment, but this is like, I don't see that part of Rick Tocchet changing. No. At some point, you're going to have to buy into that. At some point, you're going to have to deliver.
Yeah, and it's right now, and look, the team could change a lot just over the next couple of weeks, over the next few months before training camp. But if you're trying to kind of find that spot for Lekkerimäki in the lineup, I guess it would be with Elias Pettersson, and then you're managing his minutes to kind of keep him in that 10 to 12 range so he's not that out there every shift with Elias Pettersson, but... Is that the best lineup, right? Like we're saying you need to find a winger for Petey. Are you going to ask a rookie to be that guy in his first NHL season?
If you're trying to give him a taste of the NHL, it might work for a game or two.
Yeah.
But at some point, you need that consistency. And we've actually seen that work out maybe even in the playoffs, where you have kind of a special team specialist. If you go, with an extra forward, or maybe you go with less, like 11-7, right? Mm-hmm. If you sometimes have an extra winger that you're essentially saying you're gonna see a little bit of 5-on-5 time and on the power play and that's it. But in 82 game schedule, I don't think you can bank on that being it. Part of this is also Lekkerimäki showing up to training camp and showing that he's ready for the speed of the game that he's able to process. But I think that's just more of a dangling of the carrot, Jamie, for me, more than anything, because over an 82-game schedule, I just don't see that fit. Like, that's a lot to ask for a young kid.
All right, I just got a hilarious message from
what'd you get?
Dumb, but we'll share that later. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Canucks talk will continue on the other side. Shayna Goldman from The Athletic will join us. I'm all right. Shayna Goldman from The Athletic will join us. We'll talk Stanley Cup final offer sheet, RFA targets as well with Shayna, and then IMAC at 1 o'clock here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.
Hey, it's Mike Halford
and Jason Brough.
Join us for Halford and Brough in the Morning weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. on Sportsnet 650.
Or on demand anytime through your favorite podcast app.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Randeep Janda filling in for Drancer today here in studio. We are live from the Kintech studio, 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street, or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center, or Arbutus in Vancouver, online at dunbarlumber.com. Shayna Goldman's going to join us momentarily here. I do have a little update. I gave that incredibly enticing tease for some fresh 32 Thoughts preview audio.
A tease that they're going to be playing over in broadcast schools. That's how good it was. Legendary tease.
And I've now been told, updated by producer Dom Shermetti, that you're going to have to wait for the pod tomorrow. Sorry about that, guys. We actually do not have that clip. So, look, hey, I'm sure we got a lot of regular 32 Thoughts listeners, but I can tell you for sure it's going to be released tomorrow. And as I understand it, there might be a Canucks-related UFA target update in 32 Thoughts.
At
I haven't heard it myself, so I can't confirm.
But. As much as I'd like to shred Dom right now, this was a strong strategic play. Give the tease, and then hold it back.
Force us to put the tease out there. Now, he's just lucky I didn't go into more detail, which I easily could have in the first
segment. I thought you were going to, honestly.
I easily could have.
But a very smart play in the end, because now what are we talking about?
We're talking about 32 Thoughts.
The next episode dropping.
This is it's all galaxy brain stuff from Dom Dramatti.
Total accident.
As if 32 Thoughts needs us to promo it. That podcast is really struggling. I think they need to grow their audience.
Especially in Vancouver.
They need some guerrilla marketing for 32 Thoughts. All right, it's Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It is Game 6 of the Stanley Cup Final tonight in Edmonton. To talk about that and more from The Athletic and the Too Many Men podcast, she is Shayna Goldman. Shayna, thank you as always for doing this. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
It's our pleasure. So, first of all, before we get into the actual meat of the series, are you as aghast as I think I am and a lot of people are just how long this season is taking to wrap up? And I feel bad saying that because, like, Connor McDavid's doing these historic things. There has been really entertaining hockey, but it's also June 21st, and I kind of wanted to wrap up.
Yeah, it's, you know, I don't even have a problem with the gaps between the games, and I know that's been, like, a big topic of conversation, but the travel, it's hard on the players. I totally get it. And also, the NHL should not want to compete with the NBA, let alone the fact that ABC and ESPN have the rights to both, so they were never going to compete against themselves. All of that makes a ton of sense. For me, it's how late it started, the fact that the schedule was set, and I get it for marketing purposes, but it was set before the series even ended, and neither went to seven, so it could have started sooner. But it all comes down to when the regular season starts, because if you started October 1st, right, and everything's rolling and the playoffs are starting by April 1st, it looks totally different. And then, you know, the draft can be a little bit earlier. There's a bigger gap between the draft and free agency day, so we're not running on zero brain cells by the time that comes around. Like, there's a way to do this. And the NHL sets the schedule, and yet they're the ones who hurt themselves the most.
Yeah, I even go back to at the beginning of the playoffs where they said it was going to be one day, and then they're like, oh, actually, no, we're going to push it. It's like, well, you guys make the schedule. Why are you being surprised by this at, like, the 11th hour before the playoffs? Anyways, there's so many things we could pick apart about the NHL and how they do business. But focusing on the game tonight in Edmonton, against the Florida Panthers. So obviously we know the story of this series, right? Florida up 3-0. Now all of a sudden they're in game 6. They've got to either finish it out here or try to win a game 7 back at home. What's gone wrong for Florida over the last couple of games in your eyes?
I mean, I think it's just the Oilers. It was a matter of time before they figured things out, right? And the clock was ticking for them to do it. And they figured out Bobrovsky, and that's really the key to it all. I think they were able to get the floodgates to open, and I'm sure it was a big confidence thing, understanding how to beat him because he was so great for them, for the Panthers in game 1. I think that's step one. I think the other part of it is the Panthers haven't won the special teams battle. You know, we expect them to be the better 5-on-5 team. And in the last game, that third period, they were, you know, like, we expect score effects, right? You expect that the Oilers might go into a defensive shell going into the third period ahead, but it wasn't even that. It was just the Panthers were so aggressive and so tenacious. I think Edmonton had less than 10% of the expected goal share, 5-on-5, according to Nash Statrick. Like, so 5-on-5 isn't as much a problem. But the special teams battle is really interesting because it's the area of the game, I think, that you can adjust for the most, right? Because it's X number of players playing it. It's X number of tactics, honestly. There's only so much you can do. And you can watch from the regular season and the playoffs and scout that better because it's only X number of minutes per game. So the Panthers, you would think, okay, they shut down the Oilers' power play. That's step one. But the other part of it is that their power play was so good in the postseason. And then you get into the series, and I think everyone forgot what a secret weapon Edmonton's penalty kill has been for them. And it started in the regular season and carried into the playoffs. Like, they're keeping teams to the outside. They're limiting those east-west passes. So Stuart Skinner doesn't have to make those lateral saves, which he probably isn't going to do. And they're disrupting plays to generate offense. So I think Florida really needs to make an adjustment on their power play to try to gain some momentum back in games because it's clearly hurting them. And I think we're seeing adjustments at 5-on-5, like the Verhaeghe and the Rodriguez swap, that are helping them click. So it needs to translate to all situations now.
Yeah, it's been so deflating for Florida as well. When you're on the PK and it feels like you've almost killed off the penalty, and then in the final 20 seconds, Edmonton's still relentless. They get one there, and then the shorthanded goals, whether it's Connor Brown, whether it's some of the other guys, it just, you know, that really takes the air out of your tires. But when we talk about Connor McDavid And is there a scenario in which he doesn't win the Conn Smythe? Can we even think of one? Is that even possible at this point?
It has to be like people voting just for the winner and being blinded by that. I mean, the one scenario for me that would stick out, there's two, because to me, it's down to two players, right? For Florida, it's either going to be Barkov or Bobrovsky. Gus Forsling, you can make a case for it, but I don't think he has the offense to match it, while Barkov has the two-way dominance. If Barkov successfully shuts down Connor McDavid in the next couple games, and we see it's him in the next game, really, right? Or even if this goes seven and, you know, McDavid and Draisaitl stay quiet and it has to do with Barkov and he's scoring in the process, maybe he can steal it back. If Bobrovsky has a game like he does in game one, maybe the recency bias will take over a little bit too. Like, he saved, I think, 4 goals above expected in game one. It was his best playoff performance. If you do that with the cup on the line to avoid going the seven, that's got to count for something, right? Even if, say, Florida loses 1-0 tonight, which I can't see happening, but say that happens and then he's lights out in game seven, that maybe could allow him to steal it. But what Connor McDavid has done, it's just ridiculous. So if the Oilers don't win, it would be nice to see everyone buck from the trend of going for the MVP from the winning team. Like, I know it would be weird and it's different, and, you know, it's a different vibe if you're saying, like, hey, you just lost the cup, but hey, you're the MVP. Like, it's totally different than someone who just won and is elated getting the trophy, but hey, he's earned it.
Yeah, I really struggle to imagine a scenario where he doesn't take it home, given just the records he's breaking, the company he's keeping historically at this point. Now, you mentioned the adjustments necessary for the Panthers on the power play and what an edge the Oilers have had on special teams in this series. One adjustment, at least in terms of personnel, it looks like we're going to see, is Oliver Ekman-Larsson replacing Brandon Montour on the first unit power play. And of course, Montour had the turnover that led to the Connor Brown shorthanded goal. And even late in that game, 6-on-5, when they're pressing for the tying goal, it was Oliver Ekman-Larsson out there. Now, listeners here in Vancouver who remember OEL's time with the Canucks might be a little surprised that he's going to be running power play one for a Stanley Cup final team. But what do you think of that adjustment from Paul Maurice?
It's interesting. I think it's a little bit overreactionary to that mistake. But then again, it's not like the Panthers' power play unit scoring, right? Like, if they've been incredible this series and it was the one mistake, I'd be like, that is a very odd decision. And I think the Panthers have been pretty good about being measured on when to make those drastic changes. And we saw later in the game, anyway, Montour wasn't out there. I think it was the late power plays in the third period. And if I remember correctly, it was a 6-on-5 situation. They went with Oliver Ekman-Larsson over Montour. Now, do I think Oliver Ekman-Larsson has the legs Montour does and to maybe hold the blue line or get everyone going, like if they have to reload and rush back up the ice? No, I would want Montour there over OEL. But then again, I wouldn't have a defenseman do that anyway. I would let, I don't know, Carter Verhaeghe, one of the best players in the entire league off the rush, do it, or Barkov do it. So I think maybe it kind of swaps out who does what and, you know, divides the workload a little bit differently. But it's not necessarily a bad thing. And why not make a change? And if it doesn't work out, you have that in your pocket. And the other thing to remember is they started the season without Montour. So they've already been experimenting with that. Obviously, it's different when a team starts experimenting in the second half of the season, so it's a little bit more like front of mind and fresh. But if you know these combinations might potentially work because you've done it before, why not, right? Like, that should be another strength to have.
Well, you know, looking at some of the decision-making right now and the way that this series has started to go, and people have been talking about the Red Sox versus the Yankees, it kind of has that vibe to it. You feel like Paul Maurice is kind of feeling the heat here, because even though in the media he's talking, hey, we'd love to be here, this is the moment we live for, the decision-making kind of seems like in certain aspects there's a little bit of overreaction going on.
I think we said the same thing about Chris Knobloch last series, though. Like, how many people looked at it and were like, oh, he's doing too much, and then every single tweak he made worked out. I like the tweaks that we're seeing from the Panthers so far, you know, at even strength. I think they know the right move to make at the right time to get things going, and you saw all those tweaks. Evan Rodriguez switches lines, and look, here's a scoring opportunity, and here's a goal, it's up. And then in the third period, they were even switching their D pairs the last game, and you just saw the way the Panthers took over. So I think he's feeling the heat in a good way, right? Like, it's pushing him to make moves that maybe were necessary before. And I think he's been pretty good at knowing when to swap back. Because we saw a couple tweaks, you know, earlier in series with, like, their third line and knowing when to move Tarasenko to it. But they were rolling that third line of, like, Lusterine and Lundell and Rodriguez, and they knew when to get away from it because their underlying numbers were so poor and they were not scoring in their minutes. So I'm not going to jump on them yet. Obviously, it's a bad look if you're going to go down, if you're going to go up 3-0 and potentially go to a game seven, right? But we can't forget that they're going up against the best player in the world and a very good Oilers team, one of the best Oilers teams we've seen in a minute. So it's a true best-on-best series. It kind of makes a lot of sense, but it definitely will be interesting. Like, the narratives that come from it, you never know. And I don't think coaching should be one of those narratives. I think there's other things to go off of, but, you know, they're going to happen.
Shayna, you've been doing some great work on just the RFA class in general at The Athletic over the last few weeks, and you have a one about offer sheet targets up today that we'll get into. But I know earlier you also wrote about Filip Hronek as one of the kind of RFA situations to watch around the league, and of course that was resolved this week with the big 8-year extension for Hronek to stay in Vancouver. What do you think of the deal, and how much do you think Hronek can claim responsibility for helping Quinn Hughes get to the higher level he got to this year?
The deal's not bad. You know, it's a little high for me. Personally, I would want to keep him just below 7. Like, I think that would have been the ideal range. But I understand, like, first of all, he has leverage with arbitration rights. He's younger than most, you know, any UFA defenseman. He's right-handed. That's another bit of leverage for him. And his salary, if I remember right, was $5.5 million this year, his actual salary. So getting a $6 million bump might have seemed like a lot with his cap hit, but it wasn't in reality. And that has to be taken into consideration as well. So it makes sense. And I think every team deals with a couple overpayments, and you can make things work with that. It's just you have to be so careful and work on a much stricter budget around that. And maybe they feel like, hey, Quinn Hughes' deal has already aged amazingly, so no big deal there. And Demko, that's another underpayment that you can afford to overpay if you have to. And I think it is important that he's the best partner Quinn Hughes has had. And obviously, Quinn Hughes' season, he's the driver of his own success. But it does help to have someone complimentary on your right. You know, it's his best partner yet. And Drance wrote a really good story about it and had quotes from Quinn Hughes talking about how much Filip Hronek helped him and how it opened up his game and let him do things a little bit differently than any of his past partners. So I think all of that's important. And I also think, honestly, if it doesn't work out, there's a way to probably get out of that because teams are always going to want those, like, mid-20s right-handed defensemen. But obviously you don't want to be thinking about that day one. And then the whole other aspect of it is the cost they've already sunk into him with the acquisition cost last year. Like, you couldn't have brought in Filip Hronek and not thought this guy's going to ask for a lot of money. They brought him in the midst of a career year. So I feel like they had to know this was the possibility. And now you just have to take it.
Well, Patrick Alvin at the end of the season mentioned that, you know, maybe there's an opportunity to have Filip drive his own pair as well. There's more offense in his game, potentially. Filip was asked about that at the media availability earlier this week, and he said, hey, it's up to the coaches. Would you have at least experiment his own pair, or are you completely fine with what they have with Quinn Hughes right now?
No, I say why not experiment? It's not like they have perfect pairs behind that top pair anyway. I think the best teams are the teams with a little bit of versatility and adaptability in it, and you want it that when you head into the postseason, you know those different combinations that you have at your disposal. You don't want it that you have to be locked into these three pairs in this way. And then if someone gets hurt or something's not clicking or everything feels stale, you're experimenting when you're potentially facing elimination, right? Like, that's never the ideal course. So if you could figure it out and make tweaks and see things different ways, why not go for it? And obviously we don't know what their blue line's going to look like on day one of the season because they have other questions to answer still. So, you know, that answer might depend on who's available and what it looks like, because maybe the makeup of the blue line is going to say that has to be your pair because everyone else is so complimentary. But even still, I think you definitely experiment. You want to know every single possibility in your arsenal that if you need it, it's there for you.
Shayna, I mentioned your latest piece looking at offer sheet candidates around the NHL up at The Athletic today. And, you know, as you pointed out, we've only seen two in however many years, and they both involve the same teams, right? Obviously, Montreal and Carolina. If we are going to see one, if you were a GM and you were saying to yourself, you know what, I'm going to do it. I'm going to offer sheet a player this year, who would be your number one target around the league?
It'd probably be Nate, just because I feel like that's one, you know, it's probably not getting matched. They're probably going to move on from him. So it feels like the obvious choice. And I guess if you're a team, you just have to decide, is the cost of acquisition more if you go via offer sheet, or are they going to be asking for more otherwise? He's probably my number one target. But, like, I really would be looking at someone like Dylan Holloway, because I feel like you could sneak that one by for the low cost of a second-round pick, just by going $3.54 million, I don't think the Oilers can afford to swing that right now. Like, they need it that he signs the deal. Like, you see the Blue Jackets with Chinnikov, it's, what, $2.2 million for two years? Like, that's probably what they are envisioning for Holloway, and I could see them getting that. So if another team wants to just be, like, sneaky, why not?
Shayna, really appreciate it. We're looking forward to Game 6 tonight. Thanks for doing this. I'm sure we'll talk soon.
Thanks for having me.
That is Shayna Goldman from The Athletic and the Too Many Men podcast joining us here, weighing in on RFAs, offer sheets, and the cup final as well.
Don Waddell going back to his own team to get Martin Natchez.
Ooh.
Is the guy that brought him in.
One. Want some talent? Need a talent upgrade? The interesting thing about Columbus, and I don't have the number.
They could literally do anything. They could pay him $10 million a year.
They are so wild. It's just, that's a franchise. Wait, what was the Don Waddell quote about Merzlikins?
Yeah, he's got an understated approach, but his quotes are savage. This is a quote on Elvis Merzlikins when asked about trading him, and he said, let's be honest, nobody is going to trade for that contract. Nobody. That's an actual quote. I'm not making that up. That's his new team, his new goaltender.
You know what's wild, though? Somehow, Columbus does not have a second-round pick this year, which is always the position you want to be in when you're a bottom feeder in the NHL. So I don't think they could even do it if he wanted to go after Natchez.
Jarmo Kekalainen was great for the NHL in terms of just talking points. Like, he tried everything. Remember when he went after all those players and had that 1 year in Columbus, and they had Panarin, they had Duchesne, they had everybody? The guy gives you talking points.
He sure
does. Sometimes good. Sometimes not
too great. He sure does. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line, and we had people texting in really ticked off at Dom that he pulled that plug back from or that clip back from 32 Thoughts and we're not able to share it. But hey, as I said, you can listen to it on the podcast when it drops tomorrow. We'll have Ian McIntyre on the other side here just a few minutes before we go to break. And, you know, we talked a little bit about Lekera Mäki in the first segment, reacting to what Jim Rutherford had to say in his interview with iMac. And part of that answer was, you know, not just about Lekera Mäki, but about saying, hey, we have four or five guys that we actually think could push for a spot coming into camp this year. Now, I do think it's interesting, again, like as I pointed out, you know, Akita Hirose opened the season with the Canucks last year, right? Played the first couple of games. He was obviously not a major part of the team. So there could be situations where players start the season in the lineup, but then the team evaluates them and says, you know what, we need to find an upgrade here. But in your eyes, if you're counting out four or five guys from Abbotsford who could push to be full-time members of the team, who do you have on that list?
It has to start with Vasily Podkolzin, right? This is
Well, Podkolzin almost, to me, is like above that list, where it's like, if he's not on the team, that's a massive problem. Like, what are we doing here if
totally.
He's not on the team?
I feel as though he's still, in my mind, he's still a part of the Abbotsford crew right now.
Sure.
So he's on the graduating class.
Yeah.
He might be the first name up, but he's still in the Abbey crew. Now, beyond that is where it gets interesting, right? Whether it's, I think, Cole McWard and what he showed over the last little bit, he's in that group where you're saying, okay, you need a defenseman from Abbotsford. This is a guy that's got a year under his belt now. He's, you know, played some games. He's got a little bit more trusted. He's got some seasoning. So on the back end, that's probably the only name I'm looking at on the back end right now. And then Aristide Bentz is a player that got his 8 games last year. We know he's got to improve in certain aspects. He's got to add some muscle. He's got to get in his first 5 steps. He's got to get faster, limit the mistakes, of course, as well. But they like his hockey IQ. That's a guy that I think for training camp, the challenge has been issued to say, hey, you had your cameo. Now come back stronger, come back faster, and you know what the bar is now. So another name. And Max Sasson, right? Like this is Sasson, depending on, I know Drance says it that way. I'm not sure. We got to talk to Max to get that figured out. See, this is the Canucks talk, like pronunciation.
Well, I had to correct Drance on Matt Roy yesterday because he was saying Matt Waugh.
No, it's Roy.
I was he's from Michigan.
Oh, so I'm not sure about, exactly, right? So Sasson as well is not from Quebec last time I checked. Yeah. So I'm going to go Sasson. But 42 points last year in 56 games. We've heard his name pop up with Rick Tocchet, Patrick Alvin. This is a guy that had a good start to the year last year, dipped halfway through in his first pro year, and in the second half, in the playoffs, upped his game. So I think he's got the resume now to say, I'm a part of that conversation.
The other name I would throw in there, and I think you're right about the names off the kind of that are going to have the best chance, is Atu Ratu. And sure. Ratu, I think, has become a little bit of a forgotten figure in the Canucks farm system, right? So much focus on Villander, on Lekker Mäki, even defenseman Elias Pettersson, I think, has gotten a lot of hype. But Ratu made the shift from center to wing late last year in Abbotsford or partway through the season in Abbotsford. And you never want to see a guy that you're hoping can play center for you shift to the wing. Obviously, center is such a premium position. But Ratu was really, really successful there. And, you know, I look at Ratu, he's already played NHL games, right? As long as a couple of seasons ago with the Islanders and a few after he came over in the Bo Horvat trade. So he has that experience. He's still only 21. He's 6'2", is the other thing here, right? So if you found a position with him now, okay, we put you on the wing. You can use your big frame, maybe limit some of the skating issues a little bit. You have those puck skills that at one point made you a very highly regarded prospect. I can see a path for Atu Ratu being a bottom six winger to supplement the size a little bit, right? And maybe give you a little bit of that secondary scoring farther down your lineup. I feel like just in terms of the opportunity, the upside and the responsibility he'd be taking on, right? Because if you're Max Sasson, it's like, okay, you're going to be a center in the NHL. That's a lot of responsibility.
Totally. Yeah.
If you're Atu Ratu and it's, hey, we need you to be a third line winger for us or a fourth line winger for us, that's a much more manageable role for him.
For sure. And when Ratu got his games in Bridgeport and the New York Islanders, you know, his 15 games of, he's got three NHL games here, but previous 12 in New York, it was a very different situation where he was expected to play down the middle, right? He was playing next to, if I'm not mistaken, Matt Martin, Cal Clutterbuck. Like, he had the bodyguards with him, but the overall game was not there. And that was a limited sample size in fourth line minutes. Now, more mature, still 21. And with this regime, 19, which is Lekker Mäki's age, and 21, which is Ratu's age, like, that's still young in the game for these guys based on the way that, you know, Jim Rutherford has made it happen in the past. Well, look at guys like Brian Rust. Look at guys like Connor Sherry. These guys that worked their way through the system, and they let him season pretty good. So, you know, Max Sasson and Archie Bantz are two guys that are in that 23 range where you're a little bit more comfortable.
Yep.
But if Ratu shows that he's ready at camp, 21's not going to hold him back. It's about your game. It's about your maturity and your hockey IQ. So Ratu, I think, is a great mention.
Yeah, 52 points in 72 games in the A last year, and that rate went up once he switched to the wing. So I think that's really a name to watch is for a bottom six position out of Abbotsford going into Canucks training camp next year. All right, Ian McIntyre, the triple threat from Sportsnet, will join us next. We'll chat with IMAC about his interview with Canucks president Jim Rutherford. That's coming up next here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.